Welcome to Shetland with Laurie, a podcast dedicated to Shetland, the place and the people, with me, Laurie Goodland, a writer and tour guide based at 60 degrees north. The Shetland with Laurie podcast is for people who have visited Shetland, or who would like to visit, or for those who would just like to know a little bit more about life here. So welcome, I'm so glad you're here. Hello and welcome to episode 12 and the last in this first series of the Shetland with Laurie podcast. It would be fair to say that I am absolutely blown away, excited and altogether delighted to welcome today's guest to the show. And I'd be lying if I said that I wasn't a little bit nervous about having the honour of interviewing Anne Cleaves, and I can't wait to share today's show with you. Our guest needs absolutely no introduction. Author of over 35 critically acclaimed novels, international worldwide bestseller, the creator of popular TV detectives Vera Stanhope and Shetland's very own Jimmy Perez, I am so excited to welcome the hugely talented Anne Cleaves to the show. Hello Anne, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really, really honoured to have you on the podcast and thank you for taking time out of your very busy schedule to speak to me.
Well, it's lovely to be talking to somebody in Shetland. So I've been planning to come up in early in the year and then again in the spring to watch the filming, and that never happened. So I'm missing Shetland tremendously.
Oh, how long do you usually go between visits here?
Usually up 3 or 4 times a year, and it's more than a year since I've been up.
Yeah, it's been a funny old year, isn't it?
It's strange.
Hopefully fingers crossed next year I'll bring something that resembles a bit more normality, whatever that is.
Well, I hope so, because Eve Jonsson's made me a beautiful Fair Isle chair which is in the museum at the minute, and I just longing to get it, so I need to come up and pick it up sometime soon.
Her chairs are absolutely stunning. First off, I really wanted to congratulate you on your latest book in the Vera series. I've actually just finished reading last week, The Darkest Evening, and I really, really enjoyed it. I couldn't have put it down, and as ever, I was totally surprised at who the killer was in the end. And I'll not give anything away, but do you want to kind of tell us a bit more about this new book?
Yeah, it's very much for this time of year. It's called The Darkest Evening because it's about midwinter and snow. Yeah. And I suppose it's a bit of a twist on a traditional country house murder mystery, but it is still very contemporary and looking, I suppose, using that as a way to explore all sorts of things, but family and class and the countryside and rural poverty. So it is a big country house murder mystery, but using it in a very different way, I think.
Yeah, and I actually loved that it was set in the big country manor, and you got a real sense, as you say, of that kind of class division and just kind of the secrets that these big houses can sometimes hold. And I was really surprised when I was reading it. I thought that we were going to find out that Crispin was not Juliet's father, but that wasn't the case.
You've got to throw in a few red herrings.
You do. So that was that intentional?
Yeah, well, kind of, because I don't really know what's happening until I write it, so it's all a bit exciting for me to find out what's going on as well.
Yeah, that's something that's really interesting to me as somebody that tries to write and loves writing, and I kind of listen to lots of different writers describe their writing process and how they plot out a story and how much planning goes into it. And then I read somewhere that you don't do that. You don't have like a set plan of how your story is going to unfold. And do you think that's quite unusual, or I mean, is that something that you find quite enjoyable, that kind of unknown as to where the story is going to take you?
Yeah, I think so. I think partly it's because for the first 20 years I was writing, I wasn't making much money at it, so it had to be fun. You know, it was a joy. It didn't feel like work at all. And I think if I knew how it was going to end, there wouldn't be a lot of fun in writing it. You know, there'd hardly be any point in writing it because I knew how it was going to end. It would be like a reader reading the last chapter first. You know, it's I know there are some readers who like to do that, but I like that cheap thrill of the surprise ending, whether I'm writing or reading.
Do you ever panic halfway through and think, I have no idea where this is going?
All the time. Yeah, there's always a bit in the every book there's a bit in the middle, and I worry that I'm not going to be able to pull it off, and I'm not going to be able to tie all the ends up, or not even get any idea of how it's going to end. But it usually works out okay.
Yeah, and I mean, it obviously works out okay because you have written over, is it 35 books in as many years?
Something like that. It's a bit scary, isn't it?
And this latest book, The Darkest Evening, it's the kind of latest in the series of Vera books. And Vera is hugely, hugely popular and has been turned into the hit TV series. But I also wanted to talk to you about the Shetland series because, of course, I'm in Shetland, and the book Raven Black was the one that won you the highly coveted Gold Dagger Award in 2006, and that was the first one in the series. I mean, when you were writing that, did you have any idea how huge that series was going to become, or did you plan on it becoming a series?
No, not at all. It was going to be one novel, and it happened because I came up to Shetland midwinter. Because I worked at the observatory in Fair Isle, that was always seasonal work, so I'd never actually been in Shetland for midwinter, but a
No.
very rare bird turned up, and it was my Christmas present to my husband, was that we would go to Shetland to see this bird, and just a day trip. So we came up on a ferry overnight, and you know, arrived in, and it was dark, and
Yeah.
but it had snowed, and it was one of those really
Oh.
still clear days that
Oh,
you don't
wow.
get very often. And saw
Beautiful.
the ravens really black against the snow.
Yeah.
And because I'm a crime writer, I thought, well, if there was blood as well, that would be amazing. And so that's how it started, really. Yeah, just that image of the snow and the ravens. And but I thought it was going to be a standalone novel because my editor said to me, well, it would be stretching credibility too far to have more than one murder in Shetland.
So when did you realize that it was going to become more than just a standalone novel?
I think it got sold to a German publisher, and they wanted the synopses for the next three books in the series. At which point,
Okay.
I thought, oh, I better think about something, I suppose.
And your books in general seem to kind of pull you to these wild places or kind of unexpected areas, I suppose. We tend to associate crime with inner cities, and your books are all based in more kind of rural locations. Do you think that these kind of places on the edge have a kind of a greater appeal for a crime writer?
Well, I think they do for me because that's where I've lived. So I've never really lived in a city. So I would struggle, I think, to write a book set there. So, you know, I did do a couple of seasons in Fair Isle and have been going back and forth to Shetland for more than 40 years now. And I live in Northumberland, so Northeast England. And that's as far north as you can get in England and is pretty wild. And
Yeah.
then I grew up in North Devon, which is where the new series, which is replacing the Shetland series, I suppose, the Matthew Venn series is set
Yeah.
in North Devon.
And do you find it quite difficult getting under the skin of a community, like particularly like a community like Shetland that's quite isolated by its location? Because when I read your writing, it really feels like it's a Shetlander telling the story. So you've obviously got such a good grasp on the community, but how did you kind of get that inside knowledge, I suppose?
Well, that's a huge compliment coming from a Shetlander. I think that writing is a bit like acting. So what you're doing is trying to get inside the skin of the characters, which is why I don't have any particularly strong visual image of who my central characters are, because I'm on the inside looking out mostly. And so you're just thinking yourself inside their skin and looking at the world through their eyes. And I wouldn't be able to do that if I didn't know the community relatively well. So I do visit Shetland often, not so much now that I've stopped writing about it, but I do still have really close friends there and go and stay. And I suppose when I was writing, I would go up just before I started writing, because I don't write at all in dialect, but I want to get something about the rhythm of the speech when I'm writing dialogue, just to get that sort of flavor. And just trying to work out what people's preoccupations are. And yeah, it's just about imagining, really, and putting yourself in somebody else's place.
And you get a sense of that in the Vera series too, that you can almost hear that local dialect, that local kind of just the way that they talk. You can feel that coming through in the writing too. And I mean, I think that's just a huge skill to be able to get under the skin of a community and really tell the story and bide it in that.
I suppose it's easier for me here because this is where I live and that accent is around me all the time. And, my grandchildren speak with that accent. And so it's there for me to listen to.
And I told some of my Instagram followers that I was going to be talking to you, and I got a couple of questions from them as well. One of the questions I got was, would you reconsider and do another in the Shetland series? And I know you've said that you've finished, you've done the 8 books and that's that. But you didn't kill off Jimmy Perez, because you did consider killing him off, didn't you?
I did, yeah, just because of that, because I knew people would want more. But I thought I could bring him back in a short story or several. So, but no, there will be no more novels. But of course, there will be more TV, because the team are planning to be up in early in the spring to come and film some more. But there'll be original stories.
And how do you feel about the TV series? Is it what you imagined? It must be really strange seeing your writing being brought to life, and it's nearly how somebody else is picturing it. Is it what you imagined? Do you think it's true to the books, or how do you feel about it?
I think it's a very different form, and I don't know anything about making good television, so it seemed to me that it was better to, a bit, I always say it's a bit like handing a child over for adoption. You wouldn't give a child for adoption if you didn't trust the people that you were giving to. But once you've handed it over, then I don't think you have any right to meddle. I'm delighted, because what I needed to know was, I'm not really interested in plot details, or that they've introduced a new character, or even that they change the murderer. That is less important, that they get the place right, but that they get the sort of atmosphere and tone of the book. And I think they've done that very well. And it's the same production team that make Vera and Shetland.
So do you work quite closely with them?
No, because I trust them, so I let them get on with it. And perhaps because of that, because they know I'm not going to interfere, then we have a very good relationship, and I'm always made welcome on set. Well, pre-virus, and I feel very much included. So when they did the read-through for the new Vera that they're filming now, I was there on the Zoom meeting watching them all reading the first script. So, yeah, I do. I'm very, very lucky.
Yeah. And do you ever consider the long-term impact to your books? I mean, for us in Shetland, you've probably been one of the greatest ambassadors for Shetland through your writing, and the number of people that we see coming here year on year on the trail of Jimmy Perez, it's really phenomenal. I mean, I do private tours and I do bus tours. As soon as you point out somewhere that was featured in the Jimmy Perez series, then you just hear cheers coming from the bus. I mean, the reach is worldwide. How does that feel for you as the kind of creator?
Well, it's great if it's bringing people and jobs to the islands, isn't it? I think, you know, we know that the oil's running out and the gas isn't coming as much as it was. So anything that's bringing cultural tourists to the island and a bit of money, that can't be a bad thing, I don't think.
No, absolutely. And I remember a few years ago, there was a couple that came off one of the cruise liners and they just wanted to go on the Bressa ferry because Jimmy Perez had been on the Bressa ferry, and they spent the whole day just going back and forth on the ferry.
That's brilliant, isn't it? Yeah, I think it's great that, and I think that the TV show has captured that sort of sense of place so well that people aren't disappointed when they come.
Yeah, and I think they get that from the books and they get that from the TV series. It's like you mentioned earlier, it's that sense of atmosphere and the drama and the landscape that people really want to come here for. It's a very different landscape, and that's kind of what pulls people here.
Yeah, I think so.
Do you think that Shetland kind of holds a special gravitational pull? Do you feel that? You say that you come back a few times a year. Is it somewhere that you feel quite connected to?
Yeah, very much. It's where I met my husband. It's where some of my very best friends live. And certainly Fair Isle has a very special place. So I try and get into the Isle too, not every time I come to Shetland, but whenever I can. And I'm so honoured to be the patron of the new observatory appeal too. So we're doing lots of fundraising to try and get not just the old OBS back, but a new and better OBS back too.
Yeah, that's I'll put a link in the show notes to that fundraiser, because the Bird Observatory burnt down a couple of years ago, so they're trying to raise money at the moment to build a new one to get that reinstated. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes for anybody that does want to donate to that. But you've been coming to Fair Isle for almost 40 years, am I right?
I first went in 1975. I dropped out of university and I needed a job, and just quite by chance, a chance meeting in a pub got me to be assistant cook in the Bird Observatory in Fair Isle.
And how did that feel? I mean, that is such a huge move to go to a tiny remote island and become a cook.
Yeah, well, I wasn't a cook that first year. It was dreadful, but it was mostly just peeling tatties and cleaning bathrooms. I think they took me on because I'd taken a gap year and done some voluntary childcare work, and the warden's wife was pregnant and they had a little boy, so I thought I was taken on more for the childcare experience than for any skill at cooking. But I must have done all right, because they had me back the following year as the cook.
Okay, so you learned the cook okay then?
Yeah, well, I can still knock up a couple of dozen scones in my sleep, I think.
Okay, and it was when you were in Fair Isle that you met your husband too.
Yes, he came as a visiting bird watcher.
And did you ever...
He came the first year.
Did you expect to fall in love in Fair Isle?
No, I was just there and it was a kind of sanctuary, really. But he came, I was quite dismissive of these crazy birders, you know, who came and chased around the island. But there he was, and he came back the following year and proposed to me. So,
did he propose in Fair Isle?
He did. Yeah, he did. We were helping with hay making on Fieldcroft, so It was quite romantic, having a ride back on the trailer with her hay and proposed to me then.
Oh, that's a really special story.
Yeah, he did say that, well, he did say, because he died a couple of years ago, did say that it was midsummer and there weren't very many birds around, so there was nothing much else to do.
And you kind of followed him to a few different places. The first novel that you wrote was based on a small tidal island.
That's where we lived when we were first married, island of Hilbury. It was a little local authority nature reserve, and we were the only people living there, so there was plenty of time to write.
And so that's where the first book kind of came from.
That's where it was created, yeah.
And then...
I killed off a bird watcher by hitting him over the head with a heavy brass telescope.
I'm not sure what that says about your early years of marriage.
I think it probably saved the marriage, actually.
Oh, dear. You went on to have a family and you still managed to keep on writing. And I've got two young children and I kind of try and write around them. What advice would you give somebody that's kind of trying to juggle all these different things and try to keep writing and keep creating at the same time?
I think just write something every day, even if it's only a couple of hundred words. And I would slot it in. I would get up early before the kids got up because they weren't terribly early risers. And I can't work in the evenings. I lose concentration.
Yeah.
So I'd get up early and write then. And if all I had was half an hour when they were sat in front of Sesame Street or whatever the equivalent is these days, I would write then. I learned to write in play parks while they were playing and just had a notebook with me wherever I was.
Mm-hmm. That seems like good advice, actually. I remember sitting in the play park here, and I carry a notebook too, and I was sitting scribbling out notes as they came to me. And it's amazing where inspiration strikes as well.
It is, yeah. And you just have to keep an eye out for the kids, though.
And what are you working on at the moment?
I have just finished a new Matthew Venn story. So the first one of those was called The Long Call, and it was published last year. And that's been optioned for TV by the same production team, and they start filming in the spring, I think.
Oh, so, fantastic. So we can look out for more.
That'll be a new one. Yeah, so I've just finished the second of those, and then I'll be thinking about a new Vera one quite soon.
So what does your writing year look like? Do you just work on one book at a time, or do you have a couple on the go at one time?
No, I can only do one book at a time, and hardback publication is usually in September, which means that I need to deliver the book the previous autumn, because it takes nearly a year between delivering the script and it being published, because there's the editing process and then there's the copy editing process. So I'm just waiting for the copy edited script of the new book to come back.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll start thinking about a book in the late autumn.
Mm-hmm.
I'll probably start writing it early in the new year with a view to delivering it October, November time.
Okay. And how many words would you kind of look to write in a day, or do you have days where you'll do lots and lots of writing and days that you'll do less, or do you have any kind of set structure for your writing?
I write very early in the morning still, so maybe it's from the Fair Isle days, but I always wake up for the shipping forecast at 5:20, and then lots of tea and write. And I try and do between 1,000 and 1,500 words a day. I find that I lose concentration much after that.
Yeah.
And if you can't see and feel the world in your head that you're writing, then you can't expect the reader to. So yeah, that's as much as I do, but I do try and write something every day. And when I'm just easing into a book, again, it might only be a few hundred words just as I'm starting and getting mm-hmm. a feel yeah. for it and for the characters.
Yeah. And do you have, I'm trying to picture you writing. So you're at your kitchen table, and do you just have yeah. your laptop, or do you have lots and lots of papers and notes all around you?
No, because I just make it up as I go along, so I don't have notes really at all. So wow. No, it's just my laptop on the kitchen table.
Wow. Whenever I try, and I'm a real planner, I plan absolutely everything, and I love like ticking things off a to-do list, and so I always am surrounded by lots of bits of paper. Maybe it's more of a distraction than anything else.
I think people work in different ways, and you just have to find the way that works best for you.
Yeah. And do you read quite a lot too? Do you think it's important to read widely if you want to
be better? Absolutely. Of course, yeah. I think it was Val McDermott who once said, deciding that you want to be a writer without reading is like deciding that you want to be a furniture maker and you've never seen a table. And I think that's very true. You do need to read. You just yeah. need to get a sense of, I mean, sometimes you read something, you think, oh my word, what is the point of my writing? I'll never write anything this good. But still, you still need to read and get a sense of what works for you. And it's so subjective.
Yeah.
I think we shouldn't be snobby about people's reading. If they're having a good time with a book, then it's a good book for them.
Yeah. And do you read a wide range of different genres, or do you just read crime, or do you never read crime? What's on your reading list? And do you read other genres aside from crime, or do you kind of tend to stick to crime?
I suppose crime is my bread and butter reading, partly because I get sent lots of books to review.
Yeah.
So that's, if they just drop on my doorstep, I have a look at them. But no, I'll read whatever I fancy reading. What else have I read this summer that's not crime? I read The Silence of the Girls, the Pat Barker feminist take on the Trojan Wars. And that was a brilliant book too.
And do you ever feel guilty about spending an afternoon reading? I know for me that if I decide to just sit and read a book, then I quite often feel guilty and I should be doing something else. But kind of like you said, if you want to be a better writer, you should read more. And so spending time reading should never feel like wasted time.
No, absolutely not. And I think that certainly people of my generation were brought up to think that, you know, the devil make you work for idle hands, uh-huh. and just sitting and reading was something that you really shouldn't be doing, you know.
Yeah.
And I can remember when my daughter first started playgroup and going with the other mums to talk to them about, and they were talking about all these very useful things they'd been doing. Well, for their first free morning.
Yeah.
And I hadn't done anything useful. You know, I hadn't been washing the kitchen floor or doing the ironing. What I'd been doing was sitting and reading and just loving that sense of being able to read during the day again.
Yeah. And then when the children come home, then that's when you start cleaning your house.
That's right. Absolutely.
I know that feeling. And kind of moving back again, sorry, I'm going to step back to the Shetland series again, and just thinking about the places that inspired you in the books, because you gave the places different names. So can you tell us about a couple of the places in Shetland that inspired the places in the books?
Yeah, they weren't real places. Fair Isle in Blue Lightning is a real place, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, they're sort of amalgams of other places, I suppose. So Ravenswick is, I suppose, could be Sandwick, along that coast.
Yeah.
But it's not really, it's somewhere that's in my head that I made up,
Yeah.
but placed vaguely in a vaguely geographically accurate location.
Yeah. So do you kind of pull a few different places together in your mind and build up a picture of what that area or that community looks like?
Yeah, but it is very much a fictitious community, and I create it for my own ends, to meet the needs of the story, really.
And do people that you meet while you're here or while you're anywhere that you're writing about, do the people that you meet inspire any of the characters?
Not so much now. When I started, I think I did use real people as models, but that was a lack of experience or a lack of confidence, I think.
Yeah.
So now the theme might be inspired by people that I meet. The actual characters are imagined there. They are fiction.
Yeah. And who is your favourite character that you've created? Do you have a favourite?
Oh, that's so hard. It's like asking you to choose between your children.
That's true.
I think in the Matthew Venn books, there's a woman called Jen Rafferty, and she's a woman who, and she's a police sergeant, a detective sergeant. And she was married too young and married an unfortunate marriage, a really horrible husband that she left with her two kids. And she's one of these women who missed out on being young, really. And
Okay.
now she's in her late 30s. She's ready to party. And I
Okay.
love writing her.
Yeah.
She's quite predatory, and she's reliving, the things that we did when we were students, she's doing when she's in her late 30s.
Okay. And the Matthew Venn series, do you have any idea how many books you'll produce in that series?
No, I'm very open-ended. I'll know when it's time to stop, I think,
Yeah.
just as I did with Shetland and as I will with Vera. But I think with Vera and with Matthew Venn, there's a much wider palette to draw from in
Yeah.
backgrounds. Like in the northeast of England, there is the big city of Newcastle,
Yeah.
Gateshead, and then there's former pit villages, and there's the market towns and the real wild rural bits, as in The Darkest Evening. So there's
Yeah.
a real wider variety of backgrounds to choose for the stories.
Yeah, and did it feel like a natural conclusion with Shetland? I mean, you're very much hemmed in by the island's geography, and we are a small island with just 23,000 people, so probably can't afford to lose many more people who live here.
Well, that's what I was thinking, and I really wanted to stop while I was still loving writing them. I didn't
Yeah.
want to go on just because they were selling okay. I wanted to stop before I got bored and before readers got bored.
Yeah.
So it was the right time to stop, I think.
Yeah. And another question that just sprung to mind is somebody asked me on Instagram why you killed Fran. They said that they've never quite gotten over the loss of Fran.
I think I write traditional detective fiction, but sometimes you just want to make it a bit more real.
Yeah.
And so I suppose to show the effect of murder to relatives
Yeah.
and to people close to them, and not just murder, but sudden death, or even death from accident or illness has a real effect on the people left behind. And sometimes we don't talk about that in murder mysteries. It's almost as if
Yeah.
it's a game. And I wanted to show the real impact, I
Yeah.
suppose.
And it did have a real impact on the reader because she was a character that we'd all grown to love. And I think in the back of your mind, you always think that those main characters that you grow to love are going to stay with you throughout all the writing. And then so to lose that character is a shock, and you do feel it quite deeply.
Well, that's a great compliment, isn't it? That people have that affection for a character that you've created, and it's almost as if they have lost somebody that they know quite well.
Yeah, people were just so shocked to lose Fran and just heartbroken when she wasn't there anymore. So it's a it made for a great story, but a very emotional read. For anyone who is coming to Shetland, what would your recommendations be? What kind of three things or places would you recommend they do while they're here?
Well, you definitely need to go to the museum and see that wonderful exhibition. But if you've not been to Shetland before, it's a great place to start too, I think.
Yeah.
To go and explore there. And in normal times, I would say go to Mareel too, because you'll get some music and you'll get some having a coffee in the bar or a glass of wine in the bar, you'll get a sense of Shetland's welcome and sociability.
Mm-hmm.
But then go north, go right up to Eisharnes and look at the amazing dramatic cliff scenery.
Yeah.
And of course, if you have a bit longer or if the weather's really clear and still, take a flight out to Shetland and to Fair Isle and have a day there exploring there.
Yeah, Fair Isle is absolutely incredible to visit. And actually, so many Shetlanders have never been to Fair Isle themselves.
It's an astounding community, and it's so full of people with stories and people who are great artists in one way or another. Yeah. So
it's a very vibrant and creative community, and you get a real sense of that tightly knit community when you're in Fair Isle. And I think that does come from the fact that really they are quite remote, and even today they can be cut off from the mainland for weeks at a time during the winter, so they do have to be quite resilient and self-supporting.
Absolutely. And of course, when we get the new observatory, it'll be a great place for people to come and stay, because it's not just for the scientists and for the birders. It's the lodge is a great place for accommodation for visitors too.
Yeah, we went a few years ago instead, and I think, probably the same as how you felt when you went, the first thing that I noticed was that I think I was the only person there that didn't have binoculars with me.
Yeah, it depends what time of year you go. If you go in the spring or the summer, it's not flooded with bird watchers.
Yeah. And then in the evening they played bird bingo, so they were all listening off all the birds that they'd seen throughout the day.
Yeah, it was obviously a very quiet time for birding then. Those sort of games only come up when there's nothing to be seen outside.
Yeah, it would have been fine was it we were there. It was the end of May, I think we were there. But there weren't any rare birds kicking around while we were in the island. And another thing, you mentioned going to Mareel and going to the Shetland Museum to kind of get a sense of the Shetland's like story and the culture. And is that something that you felt when you came here and while you're here, is that the Shetland culture is, I mean, do you find it quite different to other cultures or kind of the UK as a whole? Because I know that Shetland has got kind of a different story. We were part of Scandinavia for a long time. And so do you feel, as someone coming into Shetland, that culture is quite unique and distinct?
Yeah, I do. And I think you're very lucky, because of the income that came from the oil, which allowed the council to support the arts in a way that in lots of places in the rest of the UK it hasn't happened.
Yeah.
That I think Shetland has more festivals than anywhere else I've ever been to.
Yeah.
Not just music festivals, but book festival and the film festival. And you should go to Shetland and just see that huge range and variety of artistic endeavour going on there.
Yeah,
it's as you said about Fair Isle, that it's a vibrant artistic community, but I think you could say exactly the same about Shetland mainland.
Yeah, we're incredibly fortunate, as you say, for the investment that's gone into arts and culture here. So it really, yeah, if you just go onto Google and just put in Shetland festivals, we have so many and so many different topics. And
Yeah, and quite different from when I first came in the 70s, but now Shetland food and drink is phenomenal too. So
yeah.
you have the food and drink festival and really great places to eat, and it wasn't like that in the 70s.
No, so you first came here on the kind of cusp of the oil industry when North Sea oil was coming in Shetland.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like a gold rush town, really, because you had the traditional crofting still, still really hard work, and then you had these people from all over the world coming in and rolling out of the bars in Lerwick, and it was fairly wild at that time.
And I mean, you'll know far more about that as what I do, because I was born in 1987, so I was born during the oil era, so I don't know Shetland before the oil came. So
Yeah.
what do you think are the kind of biggest changes that you saw in the years that you were coming here with the arrival of the oil?
As you say, I was just there on the cusp, so they were built. It was a time of great opportunity for people, I think, because they were building the accommodation blocks. Yeah, if you had a truck or you were willing to work hard, and most Shetlanders are willing to work very hard, you could set up a cleaning business for the accommodation, or you could carry men or equipment up to where all the building work was being done, all the construction work was being done. But then the contrast between that and still, certainly in Fera, very traditional crofting, very small scale, no mechanization. One of the crofts, they were still hand milking, for instance, and it was quite a novelty when the milking machine came, I remember. So all that, it was a very, very interesting time to be there.
Yeah, it would have been. It's funny that you mentioned if you had a truck, that was how my granddad became successful. Was he had a truck and he started carting things back and forth up to the oil terminal, and then he ended up with a fleet of trucks, and so that was the oil industry that really helped him grow his business, and he made a whole career out of that kind of initial having a truck when the oil terminal was being built.
Yeah, and of course now, because those opportunities aren't there so much for young Shetlanders, it is important to support those things which do bring visitors in and do bring cash in, like the music and the theatre and the art and the knitting and all those traditional skills that people have never lost. Even when the oil was at its height, people, Shetlanders, were still knitting, they were still making music. So it's great that those things are still there and still being supported.
Yeah, and it's definitely something that we have to support and something that we have to nurture into the future, because it's such a unique part of the culture.
Yeah, I think so.
What do you think the future for Shetland looks like moving forward?
I think Shetland will survive and survive well because the people are adaptable. They didn't stop the oil coming into the islands. They could see that it might be good for them. They're certainly not unwelcoming to visitors, that they're open-minded for new ideas. So, and they are great workers. So I have no doubt at all that Shetland will prosper in the future.
Lovely. Well, Anne, thank you very much for coming on and chatting to me. And it's been really insightful to speak to you, and I've really enjoyed having you here today.
Well, it's been lovely speaking to you.
Thank you so much again. And is there anything that you that you'd like to add?
Send lots of best wishes to all my friends in Shetland, and I'll be there soon.
Oh, I hope so. So that's the end of the first series of the Shetland with Laurie podcast, and I am so grateful to everybody who has listened, liked, shared, and spread their podcast among their friends. If you know someone who would enjoy the podcast, please do send it along to them. And it is true to say that without my supporters on Patreon, these podcasts would not be possible. Generating an income from Patreon means that I can allow time to do these and buy all the hardware, software, all of that that's associated with podcasting. And this has been a real dream of mine for so long, and you have really made it possible. So I want to extend a special thank you and a socially distanced hug to all my patrons for their continued support, especially my middle and top tier patrons. So a massive and heartfelt thank you to Tony, Chico, Michelle, Rudy, Antonia, Barbara, Rachel, Becky, Teresa, Pat and Gareth. Your continued support really does mean the world to me, and hopefully we will be back with series 2 of the Shetland with Laurie podcast in February or March. So if you've enjoyed, please give it a share. Thank you for listening. Thank you for listening. This podcast can only be made possible by my supporters on Patreon, so a huge thank you to all my patrons. If you would like to support me in bringing you more of these shows, you can sign up and become a patron. You will find details about how to sign up in the show notes below, or at www.patreon.com and just search Shetland with Laurie. And remember, you can find more on Instagram and give me a follow at Shetland with Laurie. So thank you once again for listening, and we will see you here next time. And in the meantime, safe and happy travels.